Fee, fee, fi, fi, fo, fo, fum. Who is the guy even Bush was calling dumb? Michael Brown, Michael Brown got shot down, that FEMA clown. We knew he'd get fired, how bad can you be?
Why is everybody always picking on me?
He came from the Arabian Horse Society and stepped in horse poop with this emergency. Michael Brown, Michael Brown, wears a frown and got flushed down. Thank God he got fired, this guy had no clue.
I did as well as the Three Stooges could do.
Who saw a city leveled flat? Who did the media laugh at? Who tried to blame a Democrat? Yeah, who?
Who, me?
Yeah, you. Thousands with no jobs stuck in a gym. Each one was way more qualified than him. Michael Brown, ask around, ran this clown right out of town. He had to get fired, he caused such dismay.
Finally, Bush made the right move without delay.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program features Mark Mickleby and his strategic vision for the future of the United States that should be sustainable.
This mass, this constant effort, this constant work about what a republic is about, what is the cause of America in the 21st century, shapes around this. Because, and this is why the concept of sustainability truly maps to a grand strategy nation, not only because of the logic of it, because it also fits into a uniquely American way of doing grand strategy. And this is the work that I'm doing at New America Foundation right now, is taking that idea of sustainability as a grand strategic national imperative for the 21st century and say, okay, what's the so what? What's the so what of the narrative? How would you functionally frame this out? And when you look at the concept of sustainability, it fits into this unique grand strategic formula for grand strategy that the United States has practiced. In World War II, we were the arsenal of democracy. Take on the scourge of global fascism. In the Cold War, we rebuilt Europe, Western Europe, and Japan, established a global economy so that we could contain and outlast the Soviet Union. And the reason why this is a unique formula is because in each one of those cases, when we decided that we were going to take on what we would consider the global challenge of our age, we did a very simple thing. We had a strong economy. We based our strategic trajectory on our economy. We aligned our governing institutions and our foreign policy along with our economy to take on that global challenge. Well, today we just got to get our brains around the fact that the global challenge today isn't a rising China. It's not India. It's not North Korea. I mean, those are all actors in there that you got to.
You can't ignore them. You have to take it into account.
But the global challenge of our era is truly global unsustainability.
Yeah.
I mean, that is what we got to get our brains around. And the fact of the matter is, you know, everyone talks about the 9 billion people going in the middle of the 20th century, or the 21st century, at 2050 or so. I mean, that's a lot of people. Got it. But the real scary number we got to get our brains around is the 3 billion people that we got to fold into the global middle class. Because when they arrive in the middle class, they're going to have a 300% increase in consumption rates. That is the challenge. How do we include them? We cannot keep them out of it.
Right.
It's not in our interest to keep out of it. And oh, by the way, you can't do that. You cannot control that dynamics. I mean, this is Epictetus Stoic Philosophy 101. If you try to control the uncontrollable, you are going to be miserable. And yet here we are. We're trying to control global dynamics to an extent that it's just impossible. So sustainability fits directly into this very uniquely American way of doing grand strategy. When we take our economy, stand on our economy, get it thriving, align our governing institutions and our foreign policy to take on the global challenge of our age. That's what we're talking about. That's what sustainability gives you. It's just not for tree huggers anymore.
Right.
And
I'm a
Marine here. I mean, we're talking
right.
about a holistic system approach that we have to we have to start activating sooner rather than later.
First of all, let me tell people again, that's Mark Mickleby. He's talking about work he's done as a special strategic assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He's a longtime Marine prior to that, and now a fellow at the New America Foundation, where he continues to work on these ideas in the Smart Strategy Initiative at newamerica.net. One thing I hear there is you're saying sustainability as the vision, as equal to what containment was before, grows out not out of idealism and not out of some sort of a leaning toward wouldn't it be nice if, but you're saying grows out of a hard look at reality. And yeah. Yet what I find so often, not so much, I don't think, in all the people in this country, but in the opinion folks in this country and the pundits and the D.C. Beltway crowd and so on, is to take someone who would say what you just said and say, you're not realistic, you're not serious. I mean, that's something you have to contend with, isn't it?
Well, sure it is. I mean, that's why you got to, you know, get an idea to action. And so I happen to be my partner in crime at New America Foundation is a guy named Patrick Doherty, absolutely brilliant guy. And we it's a whole other story about how we got connected in D.C. while I was working for Admiral Mullen. But Patrick, very, very incredibly smart, smart guy, understands economic, large-scale economic forces a hell of a lot better than I do. But what we have done is this is a market argument. It's an economic argument. Again, if we stand on our economy as our foundation for grand strategy of the United States and then align all the other, you know, foreign policy and our governing institutions to take on this global challenge, we'll accept that the global challenge is global unsustainability. I mean, that's just math. Again, we're consuming 1.5 planets worth of resources a human race right now, and if everyone is consuming at a U.S. rate, that would be 4.5 planets. Well, guess what? With those 3 billion people coming into the global middle class, we're going to start approaching that, and we don't have the resources to do it, so we better get serious about it. So to get it real, if you listen to Ben Bernanke, this is just the economics of it. If you listen to Ben Bernanke, I mean, I think he's absolutely right. You know, right now we're dithering around with quantitative easement and a little bit of monetary and fiscal policy, you know, but that's just putting a Band-Aid on a gushing arterial wound. You know, it's not gonna fix the problem. We've got to find the big, large-scale macroeconomic bins of demand so that we can push. Because right now we got $5 trillion or so of corporate cash just sitting on the sidelines waiting for a home. We've got to unlock that capital, push it towards market forces that make sense within this framework of sustainability. And we think we found the 3 big bins of demand, that this is what activates grand strategy and gets it out of the big arm waves and gets it into a realm of practicality.
Okay.
Number one is for housing, specifically smart growth. According to the National Association of Realtors, 56% of Americans don't like where they live. Specifically, 56% of Americans seek the attributes of smart growth. Mixed use, mixed income, service rich, higher density, transit oriented types of communities. We are right now standing on a demographic convergence of historic scale for the United States. The 56% number mostly comes from the fact that baby boomers are downsizing, they're going in the golden years, and they don't want to be stuck on the suburbs anymore. They need to be able to be connected to not only services, but venues for entertainment, et cetera, et cetera. So the baby boomers are now trying to move out of the suburbs. At the same time that millennials, which make up the other large demographic force.
A very large demographic force. Some people may not be aware, but that generation is at least as large or larger than the boomer generation.
And
people don't know that.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. And they are just now moving into the position of purchasing their first house. Well, they'd already seen what happens when you're stuck out in the suburbs. They recognize.
They grew up there.
Yeah, they don't want to be trapped there like their parents were. And they don't look for the gated community. I mean, I grew up in Wayzata, Minnesota, outside of Minneapolis. And I mean, so living in suburbia made sense mostly because I was watching the Brady Bunch and crap like that.
Exactly.
But I mean, these kids were watching, the millennials were watching Friends. So going to the city perk and living that hip happening lifestyle, I mean, that's what they're about. And that's where they want to continue to live and raise their families. And so right now, that's what helps. This is what creates that 56% demand signal for housing. And right now, again, according to National Association of Realtors, only 2% of new housing startups will meet that demand. And by the way, that demand signal of 56% is, in real terms, is 3 times greater than the demand signal of the returning GIs coming back from World War II. And if you remember, that was the demand signal that fueled suburban sprawl.
That created, yeah.
That fueled our economy through the late 70s, early 80s.
Let me just also say, one of the things I hear is that as you're sort of rejiggering the big grand vision from containment to sustainability, basically revising what has been in the main since World War II or just after World War II. It turns out I hear the same thing in terms of suburbs. Grew out of that era, worked for that era, seemed to fit, and now no longer. I have a feeling that this goes through. I'm willing to imagine that the next two things you're going to say are also things which just have sort of been going one way for too long, and it's time to actually, you know, not just muddle through, but take some initiative in that these changes are desired and need to happen.
Right. I mean, almost like we've forgotten. I mean, a lot of the systems that were created, anywhere from ranging from how do we incentivize mortgages? Right now, we still incentivize drive till you qualify. You know, I mean, it's crazy.
Right.
You know, there's no consideration for the long-term infrastructure costs, the energy footprint, et cetera, et cetera. The National Defense and Highway Act that was initiated under the Eisenhower administration. I mean, those things were absolutely the right thing to do in the Cold War. They're not the right things to keep fostering in keeping alive now. And yet 80% of our federal dollars go to highways.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Disturbing visions of flat-covered coffins each day. United we stand while they're warring our future away. The spin doctors dance while our young men continue to die. All for the sake of the corporate American pie. It's a conspiracy of silence. It's breaking us down. The conspiracy of silence. The truth won't be found. The president seems to have dangerous thoughts in his head. His warm-minded handlers are pushing him over the edge. Protecting the interests of all their industrial friends. The sins of the father repeating all over again. It's a conspiracy of silence that's taking us down. The conspiracy of silence. The truth can't be found. Again, how September 11th will justify all of your unjustifiable wars. It's a conspiracy. It's time we demanded they answer the questions they've asked. Make them return to us all of our freedoms they've robbed. The seeds of Big Brother have started to take root and spread. And if we don't rise up, we'll find our democracy's dead. It's a conspiracy of silence that's keeping us down. The conspiracy of silence. The truth can't be found. There's a conspiracy of silence that's tearing us down. The conspiracy of silence.
Now back to Mark Mickleby and Terrence McNally.
Yeah.
Yes.
Instead of to rail, instead of to those things.
And
of course, when you're talking about smart growth, what you're talking about is people moving in to the cities or the near to the center of cities and built around mobility that doesn't demand a car.
That's right. And we know that higher density living patterns are less energy intensive. I mean, and that's where the big, you know, in terms of retrofitting American buildings, I mean, that's where we can really, if you want to become energy independent, I would start focusing on how we fix our buildings.
Exactly. Conservation is the greatest gainer we can make in terms of energy, and you cannot outsource a retrofit.
That's right. You know, and it's also a big economic opportunity, and the demographics show that market force. What's interesting, the second big bin of demand, you know, which is systemically connected to the built environment, is how we grow food, how we develop our food.
Sure.
I mean, right now, leveraging, that's our second big demand signal is for regenerative agriculture. According to the Rodale Institute, they recently did a 30-year farm study comparing, let's just call it industrial ag versus regenerative agriculture. And it, absolutely fascinating is that the economics of it, we're sitting on a gold mine and we're asleep at the switch. Mostly because, you know, the global demand for food, according to the OECD, we're going to have to increase global food supply by the middle of the century by 60%. 100% of that growth has to be regenerative, just because the ecosystem cannot take how we currently farm. And the numbers per acre comparison between industrial ag, how we currently grow food versus how we could do it if we did regenerative ag, is really compelling. Per acre yields are the same. Most importantly, per acre yields in times of drought, regenerative ag has 30% greater yields.
Just so people hear that, the charge normally is that it's nice to do regenerative ag, it's nice to do organic, it's nice not to do monoculture, it's nice not to do factory, you know, applying factory systems to farming, but it's an indulgence. And what you're saying is, no, it's not. The yields are the same, and when we're in a period of drought, which climate change seems to be bringing more and more of, the yield of regenerative agriculture is superior.
Yeah. And I mean, and just to kind of cap it off, it's something on the order of 40-some percent more, less energy intensive. I think it's 45% less carbon emissions in producing of food. And oh, by the way, here's the cool number, is that per acre, you get three times more profitable.
Wow.
Per acre. And that's with, you know, that's taking in externalities. But this is what's, you know, the global scale.
And the other piece, which I don't know if you figured in there already, of course, is the transportation piece.
Well, sure. I mean, we're talking about
when you grow it closer, you don't put it in a fossil fueled vehicle to transport it 1,500 miles to your dinner table.
That's right. And it's in a macroeconomic scale. When we start talking about that type of profitability, we're talking about a time when world food prices are an all time high. Now, it might sound a bit Machiavellian, but we can do this at a time when it makes the most economic sense,
right,
at a national scale, and then make that transition and show how it can happen at a national scale. When America does it, the rest of the world will follow.
I mean, so housing and smart growth is the first big, as you say, bin of progress. Food is next. Agriculture. What's the third?
The third one, well, let me finish. I just want to say this one point. From a national security guy, and not just because I'm a freaking Minnesota guy, but I mean, from a national security guy, what scares me most, what we really have to pay attention to regenerative agriculture, is the condition of our soils. According to the Michigan State University study about right where in the middle of America where we grow our food, we have places where up to 75% of our topsoil is gone, is eroded. I read one study, and I can't remember which one it is now, so I apologize, but in Iowa, 50% of the topsoil is gone. Now, when you consider—
That's the breadbasket, yeah.
When you take a consideration, 100%, or it takes 100 years to generate 1 millimeter of soil, we are playing with fire. If the cod industry of the late 70s, the collapse of the cod industry, is any indication of what Mother Nature does when you mess around with her too much,
yeah,
we need to take notice at a scale. This is strategic stuff. When we cannot produce food, I mean,
yeah,
that is a dangerous, dangerous spot to be.
Yeah, talk about your pursuit of happiness when you stop being able to produce food.
So this is a great example of the convergence of prosperity and security and how they're intermeshed, and it's just not about defense anymore. So let me go to the third one. The third big bin of demand is for a productivity revolution. We clearly have to reduce our resource intensity of how we make stuff. And this is a place where the United States could just lead the world again. I mean, I'm talking about things like 3D printing, stereolithography, also talking about renewable energy. I mean, really taking those market forces and doing advanced manufacturing at scale and really lead the world in a different direction. And it's a huge market out there for it in China, in India, in Brazil. why we're not pursuing it, why we're not investing in the education and the systems that we need to do and doing the market and market incentives to move in this path is beyond me.
When you say why we're not, it seems to me the things that have happened with inequality in the financial system leading to money dominance in the political system, leading to basically a dysfunctional democracy, that no matter how smart this vision you're putting out is and how wise and how helpful, that area around the Beltway doesn't seem able to change.
Yeah, I mean, it's this is why you got to think about systems transformation, and it's the system of our governing in D.C. is not going to change itself. So that's why we got to start leveraging, pursuing going into the private sector. I think at the macro scale, the private sector is going to be the change agent for this country. Large-scale businesses understand it. Medium-scale businesses understand it. Small-scale businesses understand it. They're getting there. Now, there's folks out there that you're never going to be able to talk to, and I got that, okay? There's plenty of enlightened businesses out there that I think that if we work with them around these large bins of demand that are out there, they will create the political safe spot. But that's just the way they're going to move, and that's part of the argument that we're making. I just want to say real quick, because what I described is really a top-down game, but we're really taking a page out of Lester Brown's plan B of using a sandwich approach, a top-down, bottom-up approach. So maybe a different conversation for another time is at the same time we're talking about these big, large-scale macro things, we're also leveraging a bottom-up approach by creating regional economic clusters. This is around the economic theories of Michael Porter, Mercedes Delgado, Scott Stern, the likes of them, around this concept of full-spectrum sustainability, of converging all the different sectors of food, water, industry, transportation, education, to really create a grass-ups movement. And we've got four regional clusters that we're getting off the ground. One in California, one in the upper Midwest from Minneapolis to Milwaukee, one in Detroit to Youngstown, and then one in the Southeast, basically boxing from Columbia to Charleston to Savannah to Atlanta. All very nascent stages, but it's a way to take these ideas and put them into action, because those three big macro bins of demand, they translate down on Main Street into the four top economic driving sectors that we have available to us as a nation. Right now, our economy is geared towards retail and service industry, which for every buck you put in, you only get about 55 cents in retail. You only get for every
in
buck
return.
You put into a service, you only get about 63 cents of ancillary economic activity.
Yeah.
But if you take built environment, ag, and productivity revolution, translate those down into Main Street, guess what? For every buck you put into manufacturing, you get a buck 35. For every buck you put into ag, you get a buck 20. For every buck you put into construction, you get a 98 cents. And for every buck you put into transportation, you get about 95 cents.
Okay.
These are the big driving sectors.
We've got to close it here, Mark. But let's do this soon again, and we'll lay out the context in the first few minutes and then start getting down to the specifics.
Sounds great.
Okay. So my guest is Mark Mickleby, former special strategic assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where he was working on the this national strategy, this national narrative. He's now a fellow at New America Foundation. You can learn more at newamerica.net and look for their Smart Strategy Initiative.
A message to all the leaders of the world today. Tell them that we the people don't want another Vietnam in Afghanistan.
Now for something completely different.